This is Julie Newmar, Catwoman, from the Batman television series, and you are listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. Wow.
Welcome, Cape and Cowl fans. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thanks for joining me here in the lair, where the celebration of Batman's 75th anniversary continues. This week, I'll be sitting down with the eternally youthful Julie Newmar, the very first actress to portray Catwoman, and that was on the 1960s television show Batman. But before I get to my interview with Ms. Newmar, I want to thank the crew over at the Jack of All Nerds podcast on chaoticradio.com. That's K-A-O-T-I-C radio.com. Michael Maxwell, Derek Murray, and John Edis. They were nice enough to invite me on the show to talk about Comic Book Central and all things comics. We even got to talk about Indiana Jones and the IndyCast. Had a great time with those guys talking about the Fantastic Four, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Arrow, and much, much more. Thanks again for having me on the show, guys. And Michael also has a comic book specific podcast, Comic Wrap Up. You can check him out on Facebook and Twitter. And I've got a link to my conversation with the boys over on the Comic Book Central Facebook page, facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. As I mentioned, 2014 is the 75th anniversary of The Dark Knight Detective. Hope you caught last week's interview with the animated Catwoman, Adrienne Barbeau. This week, my guest in the lair is the very first actress to slip on the slinky black cat suit and bring Catwoman to life, the captivating Miss Julie Newmar. It took a little while before the world knew talented dancer Julia Newmar as talented actress Julie Newmar. Her first on-screen roles were uncredited but memorable, including appearing in full-body gold paint in Serpent of the Nile. Even her first major screen role in the lavish musical Seven Brides for Seven Brothers had her billed as Julie Newmar. But in the 1959 film adaptation of Al Capp's comic strip Lil Abner, Julie Newmar stopped men dead in their tracks as the lovely and leggy Stupefying Jones, a role she originated on the Broadway stage and reprised on stage 42 years later. But in 1966, Julie slipped into a black cat suit and the role that would make history. She became the first actress to portray Catwoman as she crossed the path of Batman and Robin on the television series Batman.
Hello, Batman.
You're a rare lady, Catwoman. You're right on time.
I'm rare. In more ways than that.
Numerous appearances on sci-fi and fantasy genre shows followed, including The Twilight Zone, Bewitched, The Monster Squad, The Bionic Woman, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, Star Trek, and a starring role as an android in My Living Doll. Returning to her cat-like persona, Julie could be seen strutting the catwalk in her skin-tight catsuit in George Michael's 1992 music video, Too Funky, and she was back at it, troubling the dynamic duo once again in 2003's Return to the Batcave, The Misadventures of Adam and Bert. And to the thrill of Bat fans everywhere, she can be heard on the Batman Brave and the Bold episode, Chill of the Night, a Batman origin story where she provided the voice of Bruce Wayne's mother, Martha, alongside her former Batman co-star, Adam West, as Thomas Wayne. Well, my guest today is a star of stage, screen, and television, and she slinked into the hearts of comic book fans as the embodiment of Selina Kyle, Catwoman herself. A big welcome to Julie Newmar. Julie, welcome to Comic Book Central.
Well, good morning, Joe. How are you?
I am excellent. Thank you so much for asking. I'm even better now that I'm talking to you.
Is it afternoon now?
It's whatever we want it to be, and you're just in from the garden. You were out doing a little gardening.
Well, I live in California. That's where we grow all this stuff you eat. Oh, no, you grow corn, you grow wheat, you grow all the stuff we eat.
As we're recording this, I'm very cold in Columbus, so I'm tired of it. So, yeah, if you can warm things up, good on you.
soon, and then it'll be too warm.
Yes, but, hey, let's talk a little bit about your early career. Now, throughout your career, you've been known for your incredible dancing talents, Is it true that you had your legs insured for $10 million at one point?
Well, I didn't do it. Some adventurous producer did that. That was years ago. Years ago. But they're still there.
You haven't had to trade them in or anything, or, you know, nothing like that?
No, but they're worthless in the case of theft or something.
Well,
somebody made a terrible joke at one time.
Well, that's just amazing to me, and when you see some of those early performances, you can just imagine. Let's talk about that. You got your start on the stage.
Mm-hmm.
One of your early film roles too. You did a lot of Broadway. You did a lot of films, but I know one of your early roles, 1953, was Serpent of the Nile. How did that come into your life? Did people see you on Broadway dancing or in plays dancing?
I started in Hollywood because I was born in Hollywood, California, in the Hollywood Hospital. So all my early training, all my dance lessons that my mother took me to after school, you know, and on Saturdays and acrobatics, and now they do gymnastics. Flamenco, don't call it flamingo. Everything dance, my blessed mother took me to all these classes. And yes, this was my favorite career, dancing.
So you enjoyed it. You took to it right away.
Yes, yes.
What was so exciting about it for you, just even from such a young age? What was the appeal of it for you?
I suppose I will always call myself an artist and think of myself as an artist, and in my next life I'm going to be an artist. It's just the sweetest way to be born, I think, because you get the highest joy right away. It's just a blessed kind of life and career, to my mind.
Well, I mean, you certainly have a ton of roles that your dancing skills were on exhibit there. Serpent of the Nile, we mentioned that one early on. You were uncredited in the film, but man, you made a striking performance. It's the one thing I think people remember from the film. You're painted all in gold.
Yes, my entire body. And at that time, if you painted a body, it didn't breathe, and then you died.
Well, this is a decade before Goldfinger, too, which is how they sort of played that up. Did they get that idea from you?
I have no idea, but I remember the two makeup artists. They were just smiles from ear to ear. They said, "We have the secret. We have the secret. Now hold still, hold still, hold still." They had to paint my body. All I wore was a bikini, which in those days, get this, covered not just the tummy, but the belly button. Because
you can't show the belly button.
The belly button.
Nope.
As a matter of fact, when I did a back bend, they had to stop the cameras from rolling, run for the wardrobe mistress. She had to get the scotch tape and then cover my belly button, which, of course, was just too rude.
It didn't change by the 60s either, because Barbara Eden had the same problem in I Dream of Jeannie.
She had the same problem, yes. It's mild.
Well, I'm wondering, I'm going to have to look at the dates here when this goes, when Goldfinger was written, because I'm wondering if Ian Fleming got some ideas from this, because...
He had his own ideas, genius that he was.
Yes, he did.
Mm. Maybe he did. Who? I don't know.
I'm going to have to do a little homework on this. I think when we're done here, I'm going to have to go back and do a little homework on this. Serpent of the Nile, 1953, yep.
Was made in one of the offshoots of Columbia Studio, which was right down on Hyperion Avenue, right near where my father built the house that we lived in. And the entire film was made for $250,000. You couldn't dress Cher for that now. Yes, it was. Rhonda Fleming, yes. Anyway, you can see it on YouTube if you look for it.
It's out there, and your performance is on YouTube. Yep, exactly.
Well,
and a year later, you were billed this time, but not what people remember you as. You were billed as Julie Newmyer in one of my wife's all-time favorite movies, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers.
What a delightful film, all in color. MGM, a musical, and MGM said, "What? Men dancing? We're not going to give you money for that." outrageousness. And guess what? It broke all the records at Radio City Music Hall in New York City as one of the all-time and now one of the great classic musicals of all time. So,
oh, it's stunning. It's stunning. Oh. Yeah, and my wife and I actually got a chance to see this a few years ago on the big screen, which is, you and
what?
I were talking beforehand, and it's like you had mentioned about when you see these movies on television, it's great, but it does lose somewhat, doesn't it?
Yes. This movie, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, and Westerns, they all belong on the big screen. There's just something just so generous. And oh, it was filmed also in widescreen, so there were two big cameras going at once.
I was going to ask you about that. You shot two different versions of this, correct?
Yes, you. That's right.
How difficult is that for a performer, especially one who, where the it's such a physical role? Because you're it's just dancing a lot. It's a musical. It's lavish. It's dancing.
One of the great numbers that brings the house down is actually when they bring the house down in the barn raising scene. These seven lusty men, the seven brothers, as they were, dancers, as they were, they actually build on stage and raise a barn with all everything. And then, after they've got it up, they get into a fight with the town's boys who come in and see the girls, and a fight ensues. And
as that's what happens when guys and girls get together in a Broadway musical.
They start beating up on each other and jumping off rooftops, and the whole thing comes down. But it's quite a marvelous sequence to see in this film, Seven Brides.
So you had to shoot, but you had to shoot that twice, right? You went through and then let's do it again for another.
No, they just, well, yes and no. They have two cameras there and it's all.
So they're shooting it simultaneously.
Technical stuff, not like what all the fanciful, imaginative things they do today when it comes to.
Because I think Frank Sinatra had an issue with that on one of his films where they were shooting something like that and he was said something like, oh, they only paid me for one film. I'm not shooting the other. Are you familiar with that story?
I'm familiar with a lot of versions of that story.
Did I get it even close?
You're supposed to get residuals. You didn't back then.
Yeah.
But you're supposed to get residuals, you know, and lo and behold, you get a check in the mail. And let me tell you, the stamp on the envelope is worth more than the check inside. And it's so funny to see something for 67 cents. That's
the
residual.
You just collect all of them and go cash them at some point.
Oh,
so no problems on Seven Brides for Seven Brothers with people not wanting to shoot it two different ways.
I have a sign up here in my office, and it says, it's good to be immortal.
I would imagine it is, and you've got several things that have done that for you.
Well, let's say I'm working on it.
I think you've achieved. Let's say it's safe to say you've achieved it.
I've decided that I'm going to be a female in my next life, and I'm going to be an artist. I'm going to be a pianist next time.
You've not played musical instruments, have you?
Oh golly, yes. I used to be quite a good pianist.
Oh, okay.
Concert pianist, and I even played in a series that I did called The Living Doll, or My Living Doll.
Okay, where you played the robot.
I was the robot, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So your musical talents are on display in that. Was that just recently, did that come out on DVD recently?
It did,
okay.
Yes. I think they found 11 of the 26 episodes, but it's the precursor of the Genie show, the woman who does everything for a man.
Right.
Except. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And so, I think some of these episodes at one point were lost, and now they've sort of recovering some of. Okay.
Yes,
all right, so fans can check that out.
Mm-hmm.
Before we get to your most famous comic book role, let's talk about one of your comic strip roles. In Little Abner, you played Stupefying Jones.
Oh.
This was the comic strip created by Al Capp. You played Stupefying Jones in the Broadway show in 1956 and also took that role on screen in 1959.
And 42 years later, back on Broadway in the same costume.
That is mind-blowing to me. 42 years later, you played the role again.
Yes. Yes, I came up out of the stage. They had a trap door, and this thing brought me up, made a lot of noise as it came up. But it was nice to get so much applause, probably for surviving that trap door.
What did you say when producers approached you all these years later and said, hey, can you reprise the role? How do you react to that?
Oh, I was scared to death. First of all, you have to dance. I had to dance in 4.5, 5-inch heels. So I rented a dance studio and practiced for 3 or 4 weeks just to make sure I could do all those, you know, all those moves, because you don't want to embarrass yourself.
No, and it's a showstopper. It's a showstopping role. In a literal sense, because the characters mm-hmm. stop. The male characters stop when they see this character.
They're
overpowered.
That's how the towns girls got the towns boys to marry them, because Stupefying Jones comes out on stage. They see her. They put their hands forward, and they're frozen in space. And the girls come up and do whatever they do.
Yeah, there's a line in the film that refers to the character as a deadly weapon, guaranteed to stupefy the human male dead in his tracks, while she could make Elvis Presley stand still. I love that. And do you remember who it was that you stupefied on screen in the movie?
Oh, Jerry Lewis. Wasn't he wonderful when he came out there and did his spastic response?
Jerry Lewis as Itchy McRabbit. That is a great scene, a nice little cameo that comes in there.
Yeah, the producer, and they were great friends, and he did this as a favor for the producers. It's a lovely, lovely film. It's just a delight to watch.
And you don't have, it's not a speaking role, but you're so memorable in it, but you don't have any lines, correct?
I actually prefer non-speaking roles, because the body can do that, you know? And I'm tall.
Yes, I do. I've seen the films. Yes, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yes. It's a much easier way to learn lines. It's just to learn the choreography.
You don't have to worry about the script as much. Just to hit your marks and just blow people away with your presence.
Kind of like that, yeah.
It's pretty amazing. How much fun was it to not only be on stage with it? Because you did, almost 700 performances on stage? In Lil Abner?
No, probably 200.
Oh, 200. So it ran, but you were only in like 200 of the performances. But still, that's a ton of performances.
Well, no, it pays for the rent for a penthouse on Beekman Place. Well, not quite, but almost getting there.
Was that sort of the turning point there, or between Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and Lil Abner, was that sort of the turning point that just brought you to the attention?
It was really a speaking part, again on Broadway, with two great stars, Charles Boyer and Claudette Colbert, in a comedy called The Marriage Go-Round. And they were looking for a Swedish girl. And lo and behold, there was a 7-foot-high photograph of me out in front of the theater, Little Abner, and I guess they found me that way. That was it.
So you were still stupefying. That role just kind of continued on.
Well, kind of. I was a little bit taller than Charles Boyer, but then I wore flats. But I was a little bit taller than Fred Astaire when I danced with him in the, let me see, what was that wonderful musical? The Bandwagon. Mm-hmm. And I remember wearing this long, voluminous skirt. It wasn't long. It was just a few minutes, seconds dancing, actually, through a number. But I had to dance on bended knees. Well, I bent my knees. I wasn't on my knees.
Kind of slouched a little bit?
Yes. Well, you want the man to look taller, don't you?
Well, especially back then, it was a little... Well, they still do that today. I mean, they still have, you know... Mm-hmm. Actresses stand in a little trench sometime. Not much has changed since your day when you're shooting these movies. Yeah. Then people are still doing it today.
You have to learn these little tricks so that the other person looks good in the picture.
Yeah. Is there anybody that you haven't worked with? Because you talked about all these legends and all these memorable performances you've been in, is there anybody that you didn't get a chance to work with?
Oh,
that you wanted to?
Bob Fosse. Mm. I auditioned for him once, and I swear he should have picked me to be the star of there was a musical on Broadway that he had. That's I think it's there now too, but I'm a made for Bob Fosse dancer and actress. As a matter of fact, I've done lots of his musicals, but usually off Broadway. There's always those wished for times in your life.
Yeah. Well, we have some of those memorable musical performances. Transitioning from some of the musical performances, let's talk about some of the genre projects that you worked on, science fiction, fantasy kind of things. 60s and 70s, busy time for you right now. Bionic Woman, Buck Rogers and the 25th Century. You got the season one finale where you played Zarina, Jason of Star Command, and then, of course, Star Trek.
Oh, my. Yeah, we were out in the dry, hot desert saying those memorable lines. I can never understand science fiction. My brain just doesn't work that way.
Well, that's what I was wondering. Is it a matter of you like these types of projects, or is it you're kind of there and you're just all the actress in you takes over and it just becomes perfect?
No, you just fit the part and you say the lines and oftentimes it works, and sometimes you just feel embarrassed, or this is not right for me, or this is not as much fun as dancing or singing or whatever. But it's good to stretch. It's good to do something different. It's what's the hardest role I've ever done? Well, that would have been the robot. That was really a challenge. In my living doll.
In what respects was it challenging?
Because how do you be a robot that appeals to an audience?
Guess we'll
how
have
do
to
you have
Brent
anything
Spiner.
In common with living, breathing people? And you're a piece of metal or something, or plastic.
How did you do it? What were you able to channel?
It took me 13 weeks to get the inside part, the sense that I really belonged in this role. It's you work very, very, very hard. From the outside in, intellectually, you try to figure out how does a robot move. But if you move like a robot, it looks kind of like a stick, kind of phony. And yet, it's only a success when what you do comes from the inside out.
Did your background as a dancer help you in that regard?
Oh, totally. That's how it helped me so much as Catwoman.
Yeah, that one definitely. There's one other thing I wanted to touch on Star Trek too was when you think about science fiction, you talk about some of these projects, especially with Star Trek. This particular episode dealt with some bigger issues. It wasn't just Star Trek was never really just about guys, a spaceship going through and blasting through, and this. There was always some sort of message or something that Gene Roddenberry was always trying to work in. And this particular episode, Friday's Child, was season two. It dealt with multiculturalism, different violence, the aspects of violence, trying to bring peace between different races. Did you get a sense of that when you were filming this, that Star Trek was kind of bigger than just sci-fi?
We knew that. And that's the genius of Gene Roddenberry and why he's immortal today, why his ideas are so big and they're bigger than the characters that we play. All you have to do is just fill the character and let the story tell itself. You see?
Yeah, and your character, there's a lot of depth to that. She's pregnant. She's going through, and it's, McCoy is trying to go through, and is he going to be able to deliver the child? There's a lot of drama that's going on. What was it like to work with Roddenberry and Shatner and Nimoy and DeForest Kelly and all these guys?
Roddenberry wasn't there that much.
Okay.
And the rest of it, it's mainly technical. It's very, very technical, especially any love scenes. where does your head go? Where does the nose fit? You know, when does this?
Yeah, it's not it's not a romantic thing to have a bunch of crewmen standing around with cameras.
Especially when you're naked or something. Don't ask questions in regard to that. But in a sense, yes, you disappear behind that invisible wall, and then only this inner truth, you try to have that work for you. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And
the kiss is really a kiss. You see.
Well, and yeah, you have to bring some truth to the role because you're dealing with such out there concepts.
It's a complicated thing, and it takes a lot of diligent work to be an actor. And a lot of training. And the whole point is to have it not show. So that people believe in whatever it is you're doing, whatever character you're personifying, or in whatever production you're in, and they don't see you, they see the character.
Yeah, it's a very memorable performance. And, of course, you get to be in the episode. You talked about memorable lines. You get to be in the episode where Dr. McCoy utters the immortal words, "I'm a doctor, not an escalator." He's carrying you up the mountain.
Why, was I taller than he? What's he talking about?
He was like dragging you up a mountain to deliver your child.
Oh, my goodness. Witty, witty. Oh, actors. You know what actors pine for most? We know what we want most in our working lives.
What's that?
Is great writing. You have wonderful scripts. Oh, my goodness. You have to do is show up and say the lines.
Let's talk a little bit about some of that great writing. Let's talk a little bit about Batman. Stanley Ralph Ross.
Exactly.
Wrote the first Catwoman episode. I think he wrote like 35 or 36 episodes of the series, but his first one was Catwoman. He had always said that Catwoman was his favorite villainess.
It was his second favorite. His first favorite played the Egyptian.
King Tut.
And who played King Tut?
Victor Buono.
He loved Victor Buono because he was Shakespearean trained. And he could say the words with such aplomb. And they were so silly. And he could use his Jewish vocabulary and say the wickedest, wrongest, most embarrassing things. And the critics the censors didn't know.
It's such a multi-layered show. It's like kids can watch it and get one thing out of it. Adults can watch it and get a completely different thing out of it.
Oh, exactly. Yes. It's high camp or archness or silliness or give me humor anytime.
But as an actress, how do you approach it? Because you can't really approach it as camp. Because then it just becomes this silliness.
Then you give it away. No. Actually, you go in the opposite direction. You take seriousness extra serious.
Yeah, it's played dead straight.
It's already funny when you do that. I mean, you look at some politicians. I mean, you laugh before they open their mouths. And it's just...
It's an interesting take on it. It's an interesting take on it. Yeah. So how did the do we? I think from what I've read, we have your brother to thank for you getting the role.
Well, my Harvard PhD brother, who's watching television up there, and you know, like all the other young kids, they go home after 3 o'clock, run home from school, and sit in front of the TV set on Wednesday and Thursday afternoon and watch a half hour of Batman. Wednesday started out, Thursday was the conclusion. And it just caught on, all these characters and this rampant silliness, which I love silliness, it just caught on.
But your brother He kind of talked you into it, though, right? Because you...
He did. I was in New York City. By then, I owned a penthouse and was sitting there with six of his friends from Harvard who were down visiting. And a phone call came in, and I said, there's an agent on the phone. They want me to do something called Batman? And...
Had you ever heard of the character?
Nope. Well, I hadn't read the comic strip, so I didn't know. Anyway, he just practically lifted off the couch, and he said, "Yay, do it. We love it. Go do it. Let's see it." So then there were 6 episodes, the 1-hour shows that I did, and they were, was Catwoman the most popular villain? If she was, it was because it's a male female, you see.
Certainly the most memorable villain, I think. And I think that goes to those scripts by Stanley Raffross. Mm-hmm. And combined with your performance and the costume. I think that's sort of the perfect storm coming together there. What can you tell our listeners about the costume? Did you trick it out a little bit?
I like to tell people that it was just licorice poured over me, melted licorice. But anyways, no, I just did, my grandmother taught me how to sew, so I knew how to make things fit. And I would go into the wardrobe department, take the costume, put it down on the floor of the table, take a white chalk, and draw where the waist should be, because they'd always kind of make it straight up and down, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so when I put it on, it fit just beautifully.
And the belt?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was really around the waist, but then being gold and the costume being black, it sort of added extra weight, made you look wider at the waist. I don't wear belts for that reason. So then I took the belt, and it was one of those stretchy, like, snakeskin things, and I put it down around my hips, and I thought, now we've got the curves. certain things work here.
It's amazing to get these behind-the-scenes aspects of it, because you think about what goes into costuming, but it's just
bit. Do you know where the costume is?
I do. Would you like to tell our listeners where that costume...
It's in the Smithsonian Museum.
Yes, it is. As well it should be.
Yes.
Have you visited the costume?
No, I haven't visited it. There's 19 buildings at the Smithsonian. It's in Washington, D.C., and when you all go visit Washington and do the political tour, go to the Smithsonian, see all the good things that they have to show us about American history. It's a wonderful place to visit.
And how classic would that be? Somebody's walking through and they see the costume and you come sidling up behind them.
Well, you know, it has to fit well. And I gave them one of my, the thing cost $900. It's a mannequin, you know, that you put the clothes on and you...
Oh, so that's your personal mannequin that's there as well?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's my almost 6-foot mannequin. Mm-hmm.
If we haven't already, we're adding that to the list of tourist hotspots, comic book tourist hotspots.
Oh, yes.
What was it about those scripts that Stanley Raffross wrote? Because he also developed the Wonder Woman television show, which took that character to new heights. What was it about his writing that really appealed to you and that gave you so much to work with?
His writing was completely visual. You just said the word... And there it was. It just rolled off your tongue. It was so perfect. It was like wonderful poetry. Shakespeare, 6 centuries later, not Shakespeare, but Stanley Raffross. Just the most marvelous dialogue. You wouldn't think of changing a word. All I had to do was just choreograph the words. So that I made my body do what the words were saying. Mm-hmm.
And there's we would get the double entendres in there, and then you would kind of work with those?
Yes, but a double entendre is you just say it flat. And people either get it or they don't. And also you have to say it usually straight to camera, but not necessarily. There was one scene in which it was sort of, it was a seduction scene, and I come down some stairs, and there's a railing there. So what do? But I throw my left leg up and over the railing, and I slide down, and I've got this boa, but it's a adored fox or something like that, very silly. And I stalk Batman, and it's really like a dance, because I remember Gwen Verdon, the great dancer, doing Damn Yankees, and how she stalked and did these remarkable movements. And you use the words, your hands and your body, and it's just elegant, elegant comedy. It's so much fun. Even that particular scene can be seen on YouTube.
And that's where your dancer training comes in as well.
Exactly.
That you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Was that in the script, that putting your leg over the railing? And
no, none of the physical movements. Actually, there was an interesting story about that, because as is always happens, that they were running late, running overtime, and overtime is very costly for a producer. So you try to find out ways to cut corners. And I told the director, if you let me do all the moves, choreograph it, I'll tell you where you put the camera, and we can do this all in one, that is, in one take. See, he liked that idea. So set it up the whole thing, and one rehearsal, and we did it, and we were over and out. And indeed, that's what producers like, if you save them money.
Wow, and just bringing that whole history of mm-hmm. theater and film with mm-hmm. you, that's perfect. Yeah, because when you can get done and get people out on mm-hmm. your budget, yeah, mm-hmm. you're the favorite of producers. You had a lot of different episodes.
Yeah, they ask you back again.
Yes. Yeah, you tend to be a recurring guest star. Working with Adam West and Burt Ward, what were some of your favorite moments working with those two on the set?
Oh, adorable. I love them. I've always thought that Adam West was the best Batman, but it probably because it occurred there in the 60s, and it just all came together, the synthesized, the humor, and the comic book, and the whole thing. Later on, of course, when it gets darker and darker mm-hmm. and takes on aspects of, well, it changes with the times. But I've never been jealous of anyone else to play a Catwoman character. As a matter of fact, I think that should be played as many times as possible by as many people, including all the 6 and 8 year old girls who come around the neighborhood during, you know, when Halloween in October. It's a wonderful part. It's like opera. It's like Carmen. I mean, how many people can sing Carmen? Mm-hmm. Think of it. It will always be done.
What were some of your favorite moments in the series? Do you recall any scenes in particular
sure.
that you?
Oh, my favorite moment was when I wasn't myself at all, but I was a school teacher. No, I was a dance teacher, and I thought, oh, I'm getting into the inner sanctum of Adam, of Bert and Adam, and they're not supposed to recognize me, so I'm this dance teacher. I put on this long, shapeless dress, and I pull my hair back real tight, and I wear these long shoes. I kind of look like a school mom.
And there's no way they could recognize you because you don't have your Catwoman mask on, right?
Can't possibly recognize me. I come in, because I'm sneaking in, and I'm supposed to teach Robin to dance, you could see. And so, you've probably seen it, the episodes where I sneeze and then I throw off my hair and I come back as a Catwoman. Anyways, yeah. great fun. It's the most fun when you're not yourself.
Yeah. I mean, just, again, one memorable performance after another. Now, between seasons 1 and 2, we mm-hmm. had Batman the movie. You were Catwoman for the first 2 seasons. Between those 2 seasons, we had Batman the movie, where Lee Merriweather played Catwoman. And there's a couple different... I wanted to ask you about this because I read a couple different reports. One was that you weren't available, and another was that maybe you had an injury during that time and weren't able to play Catwoman.
I think both, but they won't forgive me. They keep asking me that question. But again, other people should play this wonderful role and be seen in it. And Eartha Kitt did it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, she was a great dancer before she was a singer, and she was wonderful in her way.
Now, she took over in season 3 when you were shooting McKenna's Gold, correct?
Yeah, but she only had a half hour, so in the 3rd season. But then, you see, the show cost an awful lot of money to produce, and the producers had their ideas on, the Green Hornet, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So they were putting their attention over there. Anyways, it's television talk.
Yeah, there was a couple different. They were trying to spin off Batgirl into a series. There was an attempt to spin off Wonder Woman, like to do a Wonder Woman version, like a campy Wonder Woman version.
But didn't that come later? That came
Yeah, I mean, the show was on 3 years, so they kind of was like, hey, let's strike while the iron's hot with these comic book characters. But yeah, you were the memorable one. What did you think of Lee Merriweather and Eartha Kitt's performances?
Lovely, wonderful. Do it your way. And have as many people as possible do the role. It's wonderful. I love Lee Merriweather. She's a wonderful actress. And she's worked in theater today. She does Eugene O'Neill. She's very talented. And she was Miss America. And she's still beautiful. Why not?
When you watch the episodes, or when you watch the movie with Lee Merriweather, or when you watch the episodes with Eartha Kitt, what are you seeing in their performances different from yours? What can you admire in what they're doing?
Well, all in all, I felt the series just had more gumption than the movie. You know, when you stretch things out, make it that much bigger, maybe there was something more intimate. I don't know how to describe it, but just to say that I rather liked the television version over the film version, all in all, even though they were the same characters.
Right.
It just, the humor seemed, I suppose it's like, what's that game where you throw the ball against the wall? They throw the ball against the wall and it comes back, another guy throws the ball. Wrecking ball. If you move the walls out and you play the same game, then it takes the ball so much longer to come back to you, and maybe it falls in a different way. So maybe it has to do with size. Maybe it has to do with content or being in a smaller space. Television is a smaller space. More intense, maybe?
Probably more intimate.
Look, people will write about all that stuff. I'm hardly the one to ask.
But it's something, like you said, to use the ball analogy coming back to you, this is something that came back to you again in 2003. Return to the Batcave, The Misadventures of Adam and Bert.
Oh, golly.
What did you say when the producers came to you? Or who came to you? Was it Adam and Bert, or was it producers? Or who approached you about this project?
It was some of the same people involved in that. And it was shot at Columbia Studios in the old sets. And it was really fun to do.
Kind of like a shot of nostalgia?
Sure. Why not? Get together with the boys.
What did you think of actress Julia Rose, who played your role in the flashbacks?
Oh, delightful. I think they tiny bit misunderstood who Julie, is. But that always happens. The real person thinks of the screen person. That again has to do with writing. Oh, yes.
Was it kind of strange seeing these scenes kind of sort of
who
played
cares?
Out.
As long as she's beautiful and moves well and is, whatever.
It's good for you, right?
Who cares?
It's good for you. Hey, thing I wanted to ask you about Catwoman was during the run of the series when you were playing Catwoman in the first two seasons, did you get any inspiration from the comic books, or did you look at the character in any way, or was it strictly with the scripts that you were given?
The scripts, because that's your heart. Mm-hmm. The writing, that's your heart. You see, if that's not healthy and robust and fun to do with the speech, then how many ways can you try to make something work? Because you'll have a different idea than the director, and then you'll have a mismatch. But when the words work, everybody seems to know. You know, you're not allowed to laugh on the set because they got to add the canned laughter later. No, but yeah, it's the script.
Did you become a fan of cats after that?
Yes, as a matter of fact, and I kept adopting cats and keeping them with me and watching their movements and behavior. And so as it went on, I'm sure I got better in the role.
Oh, so you actually adopted cats and were looking at their mannerisms and things like that in order to emulate them?
Good heavens, yes, absolutely. Have to. And then with the ballet training and that kind of fluid movement, it worked.
So you were Catwoman.
Why not?
Worked for us. It worked for us. So, and the DVDs and Blu-ray coming out very soon. So a whole new generation, finally, after all the legal wranglings are out of the way.
You got it. People are always asking, when do we get that DVD? Because it's good, it's healthy, it's entertaining, the kids love it. We all like that. Place all around the world. I've been in Argentina and Russia, and they have bat caves, you know, that are beer holes. I don't know.
Did you get to do anything on the DVDs? Any like extras or interviews or anything like that?
Not as yet. Probably will.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
They're coming out in the fall, so there's probably things that are coming out.
Wait a minute. There's a Catwoman doll. It's adorable, and Mattel made it, and it's so sweet. It's so cute. You got to see it. It's only $37 or something like that. And it's got this cute little punim, as they say. It's so cute. It's dressed just like me, and it's got long legs and falls over when you try to make it stand because she's so thin and tall and...
Well, that's the cool part about the legal aspects of this being worked out is now we've got this entire line of Batman 66 merchandise and comic books coming out. You're in the comic books and all these different things coming out. What's it like to just sort of have all this? Is it strange to you to have all this kind of hit you again after all these years?
It's like my garden. You plant something, you don't know if it's going to come up. Maybe it is, maybe it doesn't, this, that, and the other. And then... year after year, you keep improving your garden. You keep making these little changes. And now I have one of the... Well, it's been said that I have the prettiest garden this side of the Mississippi River. Per square foot, I'd have to add. I live in Los Angeles, and the garden is in at the middle of the city. I mean, it's not that big, 30-something of an acre. Little house, big garden. I love that. And it's just, you get better and better with life, as I see it.
Excellent example, too. And it seems like you mentioned, this is something like in your garden, you never know when it's going to come back or what's going to come up. Batman is something that keeps coming back into your life. Batman the Brave and the Bold was an episode that you voiced Martha Wayne along with Adam West as Thomas Wayne.
Oh, okay, we did that, too.
Yes.
So that's your reward for always doing your best at every job you're hired to do, and that's the occasional sweet reward that comes back.
You seem to get to work with Adam West a lot. You've got another project coming up with him pretty soon, I believe. You filmed some public service announcements with Adam West?
Yes, public service announcement. For people over 50 who've been, they have these scam artists who try to take money from elderly people. And there's this lovely setting in Wayne Manor. And I thank him for saving me from these scam artists, you see. Oh, it'll be out, I think, late April.
Okay.
They're put out by the U.S. Post Office. That's who sponsors it.
So once again, Adam West coming to the rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And is this Catwoman reformed, former life of crime, and now people are taking advantage of her?
Well, don't you think everyone wants to see Catwoman and Batman get together?
Yes.
Of course they do. They want to know if they had a true romance, all of that sort of thing.
He's saving her yet again. Oh, it's amazing. You get to work on Batman the
Brave
and the Bold.
We have a long career, the two of us.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, too, is I noticed recently on your Facebook page, so if fans want to reach out to you, first of all, they can go to julienewmar.com, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And also, you have a Facebook page. You can get linked to that.
Yeah, I have 128,000 followers, so please come in and tell me about yourself.
Interesting picture you posted recently of you on the set of The Big Bang Theory.
Oh. Yeah,
now... nothing to tell us. So not an appearance on the show, correct?
No. Someone said, you've got to come, you've got to come, you've got to come. They keep talking about you. And my friend dragged me over there, and there were these delightful people. And watching the filming of the show is an extraordinary event. It takes about 3 hours, but and they shoot it in sequence, you see, and then they'll have a set from left to right, and it's wonderful to watch these actors work, and each time get better as they go along. It's just a beautiful experience.
Well,
and they serve pizza to the audience. Isn't that nice?
To the entire audience gets pizza.
Yeah.
Nice.
And it's at Warner Brothers, so just sign up. Tell them I sent you. Never mind. Yeah, sure. You know, there's probably a long waiting list because it's such a hugely popular show.
Well, it's interesting because fans of the show might remember this, but I can't help but think you're going to be asked back to make an appearance at some point because I don't know if you know this, but the character on the show, Sheldon Cooper, in season 2 listed his favorite Catwoman actresses in order.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and you came in
number one.
Yes,
I'm
you
sure
were.
I'm sure he's forgotten that by now, yes.
Mm-hmm. I can't imagine that you're not going to be making an appearance with Jim Parsons as Sheldon Cooper at some point.
You know who made it? Bob Newhart made an appearance. And,
Great episodes.
He won the Emmy.
Yep. Fantastic appearances. That's what's so great about this show is because there's a love of these actors and actresses that we all grew up with that have made these performances that we love to watch over and over again, and they're being celebrated in shows like this.
Isn't that lovely?
It's amazing. I'm hoping that we're going to see an appearance by Julie Newmar on The Big Bang Theory in some capacity.
Well, write to them. Send them a bloop.
Oh, I think they probably know about it. That might be your appearance may have sparked a little something there. You probably get this question all the time, and I would never ask a lady her age, but you've made no secret about it on your blog. You've written an article on being 80.
Yeah.
Spectacular. You look amazing. You're still in incredible shape. You probably get the question all the time, how in the world do you do it? Is that one of the reasons you wrote your book, The Conscious Catwoman Explains Life on Earth?
I did.
Okay.
But I wrote that about starting 10 years ago, and then this newest essay, because people write about being 80, and everyone has a different take on it, and I just thought I'd put in my 2 cents.
What have you learned what's sort of the thing that people can get from this on being 80? What is it that you've learned and want to relate to others?
It's all about attitude. Believe me, you can come from healthy parents or this, that, and the other, and genes and everything they talk about, but really it's your moment-to-moment, minute-to-minute attitude about life. And if you don't keep it positive, you're shortening those future days.
Yeah, I asked Stan Lee about this because, he's in his 90s, and he, it's like, what's the secret? And he's like, I don't work. He says, I love what I'm doing. It's not
Yes. He's full of energy. Energy is a great quality of endurance, and he has that. Mm-hmm. It's outlook. It's being interested in things and going toward that and fulfilling that concept, idea, dream, so you can get on to the next interest. It's allowing your life to fulfill your interests in life. Of course, I'm a great follower of Abraham Hicks. You can Google it and see, which is my background. I was born a Christian Scientist and positive thinking, but looking on the possible side rather and challenging myself that way. And I find that this kind of thinking really, really works.
Well, you're doing something right because you look stunning. It's just amazing, and you it's like the same thing with Stan Lee. It's like the what you're doing is probably more than people half your age at this point. And if people want to get sort of an inside look at these things, May 3rd, you're going to be lecturing How to Be a Great Beauty.
Even though you think you're not one. Yes, and this is in Hollywood, at Fairfax Avenue. I have a tenant over there at Salon Gou. Do you like that name? Salon Gou, 459½ North Fairfax. It's just above Cantor's, the famous deli Cantor's that stays open all night. And it's in the afternoon, Saturday, good time, from 3 to 5.
Free and open to the public, correct?
Oh, certainly. And, of course, I don't lecture. I listen to people and see what interests them and just respond.
Mm-hmm. Okay, see if I get this right. This is an event that's free.
Mm-hmm.
People attending will get to meet you, to get to interact with you, and find out your beauty secrets.
Exactly.
What more do you want?
This is like best event ever. It's. You remember me talking about do what interests you?
Yes.
And I really think that I do know a bit about staying looking good, whatever that stuff is.
whatever it is you're doing.
And I don't care what people say to me. They can ask anything. You know, it doesn't matter.
Oh, this is a great event.
It's just the play and it's the exchange that helps us and advances us and allows us to be as great as we really are.
And you're active on the convention circuit. You've got Ottawa, May 9th through 11th, and Denver, June 13th through 15th.
Yes.
Excellent. One of these is going to be with Adam West, correct?
Oh, I hope so.
Okay.
I hope all with Adam West.
Oh, mm-hmm. Batman and Catwoman back together again. Oh, man, you are just amazingly active in this. You know, mentioned earlier on The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon listing the list of actresses that have played Catwoman. Who I would like to ask you, who's your favorite Catwoman, other than yourself, of course? You personified the role, but aside from yourself, who's your favorite Catwoman?
There's no such thing.
Oh, that's the safe answer. Come on.
I know, but...
just between us.
You think of the great Michelle, her brilliant acting in all the films she had done. My land, I'm such a fan of hers. And Lee, whom I like personally so much. It's silly to make comparisons. It's for the joy of all. Sorry to sound so...
No, you've been very nice and generous with your time today, so I'll let you off the hook on that.
I want more girls and women to play... Listen, let me tell you something. All the girl or woman has to do is put on black, and she takes 10 pounds off her body right then and there. Now, you put on that black outfit and high heels and go strutting... out the front door, down the street. Oh my God! You're going to have some followers.
Things
Hello.
Happen.
Oh, and then be a little playful. Put on some ears. Right now, I have a pair of ears that are made out of black lace, and there's so much. Sometimes I wear them when I go to a convention or something, just for the kick of it.
Oh, the fans must just go nuts when you do stuff like that.
If you think of how many. Clothing designers have designed Catwoman outfits. I mean, everyone is outdoing themselves.
It started with you.
It started with you. Comics, really.
Well, that's true. But again, what we celebrate here on Comic Book Central is bringing comics to life, and that's what you did. What would you tell actresses taking on the role of Catwoman? Like whether it's Anne Hathaway in the most recent version or whoever is the next actress to take that on? What advice would you give to them?
Do your own version. Believe in yourself. You have it within you. Just listen to your instinct and go for the fun of it.
Some good life lessons there as well. I want to take this opportunity to thank you for your incredible performances over the years. You continue to be stupefying, and you certainly gave us the definitive Catwoman. Julie, thank you so much for joining me on Comic Book Central today.
Thank you, Joe. What a pleasure.
Well, I did a little homework, and the novel Goldfinger was first published in 1959. Julie's film Serpent of the Nile was released in 1953. I'm not saying one inspired the other, but Julie definitely did the gold body paint thing first. Well, she's always been a woman ahead of her time. My thanks once again to the incomparable Julie Newmar. If you want to find out more about Julie, including her convention appearances, where you can buy her book, The Conscious Catwoman Explains Life on Earth, and read her articles on beauty, aging gracefully, gardening, and much, much more. Head over to julienewmart.com. There you'll also find a link to her Facebook page. And if you're in the LA area May 3rd, don't miss your chance to meet Julie in person at Salon Gu, where she will share with you how to be a great beauty, even though you think you're not one. The event runs from 3 to 5 p.m. It's free, open to the public. It's the original Catwoman, folks. Go and have a great time. Last week, animated Catwoman. This week, live-action Catwoman. If you missed any episodes of Comic Book Central, check out the website comicbookcentral.net or subscribe in iTunes. And if you're liking what you're hearing, let me know. You can rate and review the show in iTunes. Really appreciate it when you do that. And shoot me an email, joe@comicbookcentral.net. You folks have been retweeting the show. I really appreciate that. Comic Book Central is on Twitter, @comicbookctrl. And you can share the lair on Facebook, facebook.com/comicbookcentralnetwork. Let's get Comic Book Central trending, shall we? Well, kids, that's all the time we have for today. My thanks again to the icon herself, Julie Newmar, for spending some time with me in the lair, celebrating Batman's 75th anniversary. Next week on Comic Book Central, from the depths of the Batcave to broadcasting in the Comic Book Central lair, what better way to celebrate the 75th anniversary of Batman than by chatting with the man who has portrayed the Dark Knight more than any other actor in history? Kevin Conroy, the voice of Batman in the DC Animated Universe, will be right here. Don't you dare miss this one. And speaking of the animated Batman, this Wednesday, April 9th at 6:30 p.m., 5:30 Central, Cartoon Network is airing a brand new animated short for Batman's 75th anniversary. It's produced by none other than Batman the Animated Series co-creator Bruce Timm, and it's done in 1940s style. Should be amazing, so check it out. Until next time, have a brilliant Bat Week. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
Oh my goodness, no one has been so thorough. I thank you for your enthusiasm.